The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm the Director of Author Events here. And if you've been attending the lectures over the years, you've had the opportunity to meet some of the top names in the news business, including Ted Koppel, Leslie Stahl, Andrea Mitchell, Bob Schieffer, Dan Shore, and just last night, Cokie Roberts. This afternoon, it is my pleasure to welcome one of the most respected reporters and anchors in the history of television news. In his entertaining new book, The Place to Be, Roger Mudd takes us from his time as a cub reporter at the Richmond News Leader through the glory days of television news broadcasting at CBS, where he covered some of the most important stories of the day. Roger Mudd is the recipient of numerous awards, including the George Foster Peabody Award, the Joan Shorenstein Award for Distinguished Washington Reporting, and 5 Emmy Awards. It's my honor to welcome Roger Mudd.
Well, it's always a delight to be in Philadelphia, and I read this morning that you distinguished yourself again by becoming the only area in the whole state that Obama carried. word got out about this book, one of the first invitations I got to talk about it was from the Free Library of Philadelphia. So this book tour that I'm on is built around you. I began in Fort Worth, and then San Diego, and Los Angeles, and Santa Barbara, and San Francisco, and Seattle, and Philadelphia. Just seeing this magnificent edifice, which is the first time I've been in this building, reminds me of how critical libraries are to our society. I remember the day I got my first library card in Washington, D.C. It's 1935. I was 7 years old. And my father, wearing his Palm Beach suit and his hat and his perforated summer shoes, took me and I signed this marvelous card, not plastic, but good, heavy, thick paper. And I signed in ink while the librarian watched me and my father watched me. And on that day, my society recognized me as a person, someone who was old enough and responsible enough to obey the rules of society, check out things and bring them back on time and in good condition. I first came to Philadelphia 60 years ago as a member of my college crew, and we raced in the opening regatta between Penn and Rutgers. Our coach had stroked the Penn crew back in 1932 and 3, and our coach got an invitation from his old coach, Rusty Callow, who was then coaching, of course, the Penn crews. And they invited us to come up and be a guest in this regatta. We lost badly to Penn. We lost by 6 lengths. But we damn near beat Rutgers. I remember after the race, the tradition was that you go to the opposing oarsman and you take your shirt off and you give it to him. And that day I stripped my shirt off and gave it to Jack Kelly Jr., who was rowing 6 in the Penn crew. The next year, Rutgers came down to Virginia, down to Washington and Lee, and we beat them by 4 feet. Well, this is the first book I've ever written, and I'm very proud of it, and I carry it around with me, and I hug it, and I love the heft of it, and the permanence of it, and the, there's a perfume to a brand new book. Recently, I read about the newest interactive museum in Washington called the Newseum. And in it is a, it's a, underwritten and sponsored by the Freedom Forum and USA Today. One of the features of this museum is called You Too Can Be a TV Reporter. And it's set up so that the young and the old can stand in front of a camera. You can pick the background that you want behind you, Supreme Court, State Department, White House, Congress, so forth. And they have a little teleprompter, and you stand there, and you pretend you're a TV reporter. And you say your little thing, and they give you a videotape, and you go home and show all your classmates that you are now a TV reporter. Of course, there's no mention of the waiting and the hard work and the sweating and the research and the arguing and the traveling that goes into being a TV reporter. So this book that I've written is, I hope, an antidote to the idea that all it takes to be a TV reporter is a little pancake makeup and a teleprompter. This book is about an era in television news that some of you may be too young to remember. Others may remember it but have forgotten the details about it. And there must be some of you who are as old as I am who do remember it and only wish it would return. 30 years ago, the CBS Evening News was anchored not by Dan Rather or Bob Schieffer or Katie Couric, but by Walter Cronkite. The NBC Nightly News was anchored not by Brian Williams or Tom Brokaw or John Chancellor, but by Huntley and Brinkley. And the ABC World News Tonight was anchored not by Charlie Gibson or Peter Jennings or Max Robinson, but by Frank Reynolds and Harry Reasoner. Back then, when you did a story on the evening news, you began at the beginning. The Senate today finally broke the civil rights filibuster. You did not say, "Good evening, Walter," as if you hadn't spoken to him just 10 minutes before you went on the air. And when you finished, you did not say, "Walter." And Walter did not thank you for doing the story, knowing that you made $250,000 a year and that that was thanks enough. And when you were in the field reporting, you did not walk and talk. You did not wave your hands or wiggle your hands. Anybody back then who walked and talked and flapped their hands was considered a bad actor. Today, walking, talking, and flapping is de rigueur. Those were the days of the hour-long documentaries, CBS reports, NBC's white papers, when the subjects were serious, and they were an hour long, and the reporting was strong, balanced, migrant labor, the McCarthy era and the Red Scare of the 60s, of the 50s, the gambling, the drugs, the Pentagon's public relations budget, race in America. Walter Cronkite's evening news was hard news. The program was divided into five sections, separated by four commercials, each one a minute long. That added up to 4 minutes of commercials. The four sections were all hard news. The fifth section was Severide, Eric Severide, perhaps, or a Charlie Kuralt on the road. Today, the CBS Evening News with Katie Couric is different and softer. There are four sections divided by six commercials, totaling 6 minutes and 45 seconds. The first 7 to 8 minutes is hard news. The rest is features. Lifestyles, how to train your dog. The reason for this, the reason for 8 minutes versus 10, 12 minutes of features, is that by the time most of us get home to turn on the TV at 6:30, we already know, generally, what's happened. We know because of the Internet, because of cable, because of radio, cell phones, iPods, Blackberries, Blueberries. The audience on cable isn't large, perhaps 3 to 4 million, but it has been big enough to force the broadcast evening news to reprogram themselves and rearrange themselves. Before the internet arrived, the combined audience of the three network broadcast news programs was 52 million. Today it is 27 million. You know what other program has an audience of 27 million? American Idol. You watch it, don't you? Most of you have a pretty good idea of what this media world is like. Upwards of 350 cable channels. Everything from music video to sports to the movies. The big three are Fox, MSNBC, and CNN, founded by Ted Turner in 1980. Its stars are Wolf Blitzer, Lou Dobbs, Anderson Cooper, and Larry King. CNN's big break came in 1991 when it was the only news outlet to get a signal out of Baghdad during that evening bombing. When Wolf Blitzer was first becoming known, The New Yorker ran a cartoon, and the scene was the Three Little Pigs' house. And there came a knock on the door, and one of the pigs ran to the door and opened the door. And then he ran back and told the other pigs, he says he's Wolf Blitzer. The new technologies that I mentioned are turning journalism upside down. The convenience and the speed of this new world are mind-boggling. Having this machinery in our homes and on our very desks makes us feel very comfortable in this new world. And for journalists, access to this information is now instantaneous, and the impact of live television, pictures from Tiananmen Square, the wall in Berlin, from the exploding skies over Baghdad, their impact on the destinies of nations has been incalculable. I have been reading, and I'm sure you have, I've been reading with considerable and understandable shock at the recent coverage of the troubles at CBS News, that Katie Couric may be on the way out after 18 months of trying to get her program out of third place, and rumors that CBS is talking about outsourcing its news coverage with CNN. Most of those stories are iffy, but somebody high up at CBS is doing a lot of leaking. I found that after 50 years in television, most rumors come true in the end, if you only wait long enough. If Katie Couric is let go, CBS has no powerhouse to replace her. Bob Schieffer did a first-rate job in holding the fort while they waited for Katie to come over from NBC. But Bob's hair is now white, and he told me the other day he's approaching his 71st birthday. So any Schieffer replacement would be only temporary. The fact is that the three network evening news programs have lost their pivotal position in American society. Their influence has been diminished by a changing set of anchors, the loss of viewers to the cable and the internet and the bloggers, the phenomenal popularity among the young of the faux news anchors, Colbert and Jon Stewart, and the unvarnished partisans like Bill O'Reilly and Keith Olbermann, Sean Hannity and Lou Dobbs. Thinking back about the glory days of CBS and the current doldrums at CBS put me in mind of one of the great songs from Evita. And with apologies to Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, I wrote down, "Don't cry for me, Columbia. The truth is, you finally left me." When I went to work in Washington in 1956, reporters were using things that you and I don't see anymore. Carbon paper, stencils, mimeograph machines, vacuum tubes, flash bulbs, film cameras, and dare I say, typewriters. Within 5 or 6 years, there were transistors, TV sets in every home, Xerox machines, tape recorders, jet planes that brought Paris within 6-7 hours of New York. By the early 70s, there was videotape, up and down links, jet planes were obsolete, and there was no place in the world beyond the reach of television. But that's not the way it was when I started. After a brief fling as a rewrite man on the evening paper in Richmond, Virginia, I was hired by the newspaper's radio station and given the title of news director. I had never broadcast before. No one had told me how to do it. They showed me where the wire machine was, and I ripped off copy, and I put together the new newscast. And it was during the spring of 1956, and Pope Pius the 12th was very ill, and there was a story from Rome. And to my horror, I heard myself say, "The condition of Pipe Pois has grown steadily worse, and they have summoned to the Pipe's bedside a Vatican specialist and two swish specialists." The problem was that on my desk was what was known as a cough box, and it has a switch on it, two switches, and one's cut on and off, and it was to clear your throat if you had a problem. Well, I hit the wrong switch. And so for the next 5 or 6 seconds, all you heard was me laughing, followed by bursts of just dead air. It sounds funny now, but that back then it was not funny. After a couple of years in Richmond, and then at WTOP in my hometown of Washington, I was hired by CBS, which was, if you were a television reporter, the place to be in the early 60s. So let me tell you a little about the place to be. Howard K. Smith was the bureau chief in Washington, and he hired me. My starting salary was $19,000 a year. Within a few years, there was no news bureau like it anywhere in television. There was Daniel Shore covering Johnson's Great Society and then Watergate. There was Marvin Kalb covering the State Department and looking very much like a diplomat himself. Dan Rather at the White House, tough at the White House, driving the Nixon people nuts. Bob Pierpoint, always reliable. George Herman, our reliable encyclopedia man on everything, running Face the Nation. Bob Schieffer, the young versatile Texan covering the Pentagon. And I was on Capitol Hill. That was the front row. But on the back row, the second string, so-called, Connie Chung, Ed Bradley, Leslie Stahl, Bruce Morton, Phil Jones, Bernard Shaw, Rita Braver, Fred Graham, Bernie Kalb, Ike Pappas, Bill Plant. And, of course, there was Eric Severide, whose nightly analysis was without equal. We were all in awe of Eric. We all called him Mr. Severide. Nobody dared call him Eric. Most of us hesitated to say anything except good morning. New arrivals in the bureau quickly learned the four rules of Severide. Never talk to Eric in the hall. Never talk to Eric in the elevator. Never talk to Eric in the men's room. Never talk to Eric. The stories that the Bureau was witness to and got to cover during those 20 years meant we nearly monopolized the output of CBS each night. From our dawn-to-dusk coverage of the Great March on Washington in 63, our superlative work during the funeral of John Kennedy, the Senate civil rights filibuster, the civil rights movement, the murder of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, the landing on the moon, the Vietnam War and its impact on the government, the rising protests against the war, the unequal reporting of the Bureau during Watergate, the sleazy end of Spiro Agnew, the last bitter days of the Nixon presidency, the rise of the unelected Gerald Ford, the arrival and quick departure of Jimmy Carter, and in between five presidential campaigns. That 20-year stretch was unlike any in our history that I remember, for the changes that it wrought, for its political upheaval, the growing distrust of the government, and the sheer excitement that those stories generated. What I've set out in this book is not a retelling of all those events, because they have been told brilliantly before, but it's an account of the men and women, the 50, 60 men and women who came through that bureau in those 20 years, and how they covered those stories under enormous pressure, not only from their own standards of journalism, but also from a hostile White House, a suspicious Congress, and an increasingly nervous corporate headquarters in New York. 10 days after I started at CBS in 1961, I blew my first assignment. Mildred Gillars, known as Axis Sally, sentenced to prison, was about to be released from the woman's reformatory in Alderson, West Virginia. So I was sent down on my first out-of-town assignment with a film crew. And the plan was that she was to come out. The prison people had told us she'll be coming through the gate there at 6:30. So it was, of course, dark. And our camera crew, and there are a lot of crews there, set up outside the gate. And the plan was that as the car came by, I would be standing there. And I'd written my little piece, you know, something dumb like Axel Sally faces an uncertain future, you know, and the car was to go by. Well, suddenly here she comes. So here came this long car, windows rolled up, you couldn't see, and I started my little thing. And I froze, forgot my lines. I said, take two. Tried it again, froze again. By this time, the car was out of sight. So on the third crack, I finally made it. And let me read to you the little sentence about that. I froze. Take three. I made it on the third try, but by this time, Axis Sally and her car had vanished in the dark. My closer was now worthless. My on-camera debut would have to wait. What the CBS Evening News got that night was my disembodied voice behind a piece of film showing the viewer who was told that a car carrying someone thought to be a woman who was alleged to be Axis Sally. Well, during those first months at CBS, I was, pardon me, the weekend anchor man, weekend relief man, sorry, at the White House. And when John Kennedy would go off to Newport, I'd go with him if it were a Saturday, Sunday. And on one trip we took to Newport, halfway through we got word that Speaker Sam Rayburn was dying down in Texas, and the president wanted to fly down to pay his last respects. So we all flew down and covered the story, and we were back at the Air Force Airport near Dallas-Fort Worth, and I was on the telephone dictating a story to the radio desk in New York, and I was a slow writer, and I was new and didn't know quite what to do and how fast I ought to write. By the time I got through, the rear steps of Air Force One were up. Those steps are the steps that the press uses. The president's steps were still there, but there was a master sergeant about ready to roll the steps away and close the door. And Frank Cancellari, an AP photographer, saw me from the plane and yelled up to Pierre Salinger, "Salinger, hold it, wait for the kid." That's me. So out I ran, and they kept the steps, and up into Air Force One I came. And I walked right into the bedroom of the President of the United States. And, you know, when you go into a plane like that, there are closets for hang coats and stuff. And there stood the President, and Salinger's ready to choke me if I dared say a word to the President. But in that closet were shelves, 10, 12 shelves all the way, and every shelf was filled with freshly laundered shirts. And I found out later that because he wore that brace, he must have sweated a lot. So every time he got off Air Force One, he would change his shirt. So there I am on the and here's the president, and I'm going like this, trying to get by. But all I can remember is, you remember in The Great Gatsby, how Daisy Buchanan was so impressed with Gatsby's shirts. That's all I could think of that day. Well, in 1964, I was assigned to cover the Goldwater campaign. Back then, it was all film. No such thing as videotape. No such things as satellites. You couldn't feed from anywhere in the world. You had to get the film back to New York in a variety of ways. Sometimes you'd fly it back if you were not on a deadline, but mostly if you were covering a breaking story back then, you had to feed the film on telephone lines back to New York. So every place you stopped with a breaking story, you had to arrange with the local Bell telephone company to set up leased lines. And you'd rent a telephone line for 30 minutes and feed the film back to New York, and they would take it, record it, and work it into the Cronkite show. So in September of 1964, Barry Goldwater knew he was going to lose. Everybody knew he was. He knew it, but he wanted to make one valiant attempt. So he decided to put together a real whistle-stop train. So early one morning out of Union Station, this 22-car-long train pulled out, heading for Parkersburg, West Virginia, and the small towns of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. Within a couple hours, the campaign train was in shambles. Vic Gold, the press secretary on the Goldwater campaign, had discovered there was on the train a Democratic spy put there by Dick Tuck, who was the great Democratic prankster. This young woman had secreted in her baggage a mimeograph machine, and in her bedroom she was cranking out anti-Goldwater screeds and placing them under the doors of all the reporters. So as we pulled into Parkersburg, West Virginia, in the early dawn, Vic Gold alerts all the camera crews and banishes this woman to the freight yards of Parkersburg. And there she sat, beautiful young 22-year-old woman with her little mimeograph machine. Nobody around her, and the train pulls out. And so we're dying to get this story back to New York. It's a great story. The spy who was sent out into the cold, right? But you had to get to a place where you could feed. So we got off. The train pulled out of Parkersburg. We got off the train in Chillicothe, rented a car, the producer, Murray Frompson, and I, and drove like a bat out of hell to Cincinnati, where we knew we had a good, reliable station. We got to the station. It was 5:30. The film went immediately into the soup to be developed. We had one shot to make it on the Cronkite show. We needed an edit room, an editor, and we needed someone to get a hold of Ohio Bell to lease a line so we could feed the story before 6:30. So we got the line, we got the film out, we got it edited, and it was 6:20 when Murray called New York, and Don Hewitt, the director of the evening news, said, you got to feed it first. He said, Don, you're going to have to take it live. We will not be ready. Hewitt knew that if you wanted to go live, something bad would happen, because it always did. So the broadcast begins, and Cronkite switches to Dan Rather, who is somewhere with Lyndon Johnson. And then he says, and now for that story from the Goldwater campaign, here's Roger Mudd. So up comes my face and my microphone. I've recorded this piece at Chillicothe. And instead of hearing my voice, what you heard, because Ohio Bell had not punched us into New York, they'd hooked us up to a local radio station. And at that very moment, it was playing a Kay Kaiser tune called Three Little Fishes. So here I am. You know, my mouth is moving like this. And what they're hearing is, boop, boop, diddum, dottum, wantum, chew. Boop, boop, diddum, dottum, wantum, and they swam all over the dam. You remember that? Well, you laugh then. But I'm telling you, it was not a funny moment. Back then it wasn't. Well, anyway. So this great Washington Bureau that I've written about and told you a little bit about, was really the result of a perfect storm. It was a rare combination of principled leadership at the top, talented and honest journalists, dedicated and skilled producers, editors, photographers, couriers, and all of us locked in on 20 years of stories unequaled for their importance, their drama, and their violence. We felt unique to have been a part of it. Why else would we have spent so much time and energy arguing about our stories, screening the footage, writing and rewriting our copy, losing our tempers over mistakes or blown feeds or boop, boop, diddum, doddums? We were furious at being passed over. We had no doubts about how good we were. We had no doubts about our values. We had no doubts about what our mission was, and it was to cover the news without flattering or tricking the viewer. Most of us thought of ourselves as being chosen. It was as if we had been lifted up by a journalistic deity and dropped down in the middle of the Washington Bureau to serve our country by doing God's work. That's all I'm going to say right now. I would love to have your questions. You've been a great audience. Thank you very much.
Well, most of you know how this works. If you hold your hand up, we'll get a mic. Please wait for the microphone. Who would like to start us off right here in the third row?
Do you think the lack of sophistication and depth of news coverage today has something to reflect to the audiences that listen to it?
I'm sorry that the sound was bouncing.
Does the lack of the depth of coverage reflect the audiences that watch and listen?
Well, so the question was, does the lack of depth on the news broadcast reflect the lack of depth in the audience? Is that correct? Is that the question? Well, yes. Yes. It's a difficult problem. When I mentioned the audience of American Idol of 27 million equals that of all three networks, you understand why it's that way. The question is, should the network, the broadcast networks, ignore the tastes of the popular audience and give them good documentaries and say, the hell with you, I know you're not going to watch, but you ought to, and then watch their profits drop? So you don't know which comes first. I think with the explosion of channels, I think the quality has dropped immeasurably. If you remember when there were just three networks and maybe a third or the fourth, the quality was pretty good. And as I've tried to indicate, the news was serious and the men and women who worked at it were serious. But with deregulation, which came beginning with Carter and then was carried on with a vengeance by Reagan, from 5 or 10 channels, it was 20, 50, 100. It was 535 now. And so that pie that used to be sliced up 4 or 5 ways is now just a sliver. So every little niche cable is trying to hold its little piece of the audience. To do that, you can't put on a program in which they take that zapper because you're dead. They do. So that's what's happened. I mean, I always thought that competition was terrific, and it led to a better product. But I must say, because of the peculiarity of television and its strange hold on the public, I'm not sure I believe that in this case. I'm not convinced that competition has helped us. It's added a lot of voices, and that's good. But so much of it is just ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-
first off, I want to say that I was so disappointed that you didn't get to sit in the anchor chair after Cronkite left. I stopped watching CBS Evening News. Okay. The second comment, which leads to the question, is that while Philadelphia got Obama, he didn't get my vote.
Okay.
And the third question is that I think that there, even though he's going to be the de facto candidate for the Democrats, because let's face it, the numbers are working against her. My question for you is because I know you've been it, you've seen the game and know how it's played. The only way that I think that he can slam dunk this over McCain is if he takes General Clark as a running mate, because I don't think Bill Webb has the experience. But I was just wondering, I mean, I know there are other people that are bandied
around. What's your specific question,
man? Do you see that as a possibility for
him? An Obama Clark ticket?
Yes.
Well, General Clark tried it once before, didn't he?
Yes.
He didn't go very far. In fact, I don't think he ever got out of the starting gate, really. I would it's an interesting possibility, but I wouldn't think that would work. Something about former military men, even though he broke with the military, something about former military men in high civilian office, I think, is probably doesn't go down well with the public. Did I hear approval? That's right. Well, Eisenhower was no General Clark is no Eisenhower, if I may say.
Another question about 10 rows back in the green.
I'm thrilled to be here to listen to you. What is to happen to us? You come to Philadelphia, where we have one newspaper. If the Katie Couric is now almost history, what is going to happen to the evening news? Not everyone is on the internet 24/7. What's going to happen?
Well, television, particularly at CBS, is in such tumult. It's really, really hard to predict. It appears, and you know, I'm not in the loop anymore. I've been retired for some time, and longer ago than that from CBS. But assuming that she goes, they'll have a hard time finding, unless maybe they'll begin raiding other networks to find a replacement. But my view is that because the broadcast networks are licensed and are given access to the airwaves, which belong to us, that those networks who have made and are making and will make an awful lot of money, have an obligation, no matter whatever happens out in the blogosphere or with the internet, have an obligation every night to present to the audience a thoughtful account of what happened in the previous 24 hours. No matter how small the audience gets, I think they have that obligation. I don't think that the evening news will disappear. I think there'll be economic rearrangements, and there may be outsourcing of the coverage. But I don't think that in good conscience the networks can in fact shut down the evening news. I mean, that's about the only prediction I can make. Because you just don't know. I never thought that CBS would ever consider outsourcing its material. And they may not, but they're talking about it at least.
Let's go right here in front, lady in white.
Hi. With the large number of people that seem to be watching the faux commentators of the news, what do you think the effect of those commentators' shows are on hard news broadcasters and also on the perception of the general population of the information that comes to them?
Well, what happens is that when Hillary Clinton or Obama go on Jon Stewart, that phony faux stuff gets put onto the evening news and becomes the news. So the line between the so-called real news and the faux news get so mixed up that you don't know what's right, true and what isn't. I must say the audience for Stewart and Colbert are large among the young people, and an awful lot of young people get their news in that funny kind of way from those programs. But I think because of the success of Stewart, particularly Stewart, I think networks are trying to lighten things up. And I think, you know, that's treacherous.
Gentleman right in front here.
Do you think that the Democrats are going to end up with a Clinton-Obama ticket?
Not Obama-Clinton, but Clinton-Obama? Either one? Either one. No. I mean, I think, you know, that's... I never thought that the Kennedy-Johnson competition back in 1960 was as negative and snippy as this one has gotten. And so, therefore, it was easier for Johnson and Kennedy to get together, although Robert Kennedy hated the whole idea. But Kennedy knew that he had to have somebody from a big state or he would lose, and that was a practical decision. I'm not sure that Obama and Senator Obama, Senator Clinton, and their staffs have that same relationship. I think there's too much bitterness right now for them to enter into serious talks about it. But, you know, in the beginning of this campaign, every star in the sky was aligned for a Democratic victory. But you got to leave it to the Democratic Party to screw it up. So it could be that you know, when they come right down to it, that's the only way they can beat the Republicans.
Time for a few more questions, folks. If you could stop taking pictures, please, we could do that upstairs. Gentleman in red, right here.
At one time, you interviewed Bobby Kennedy and asked him very directly, why do you want to be president? And I have two questions. Number one, how did he respond to you? And why was that encounter later characterized in the press as a Roger Mudd moment?
Well, it was Teddy Kennedy, not Robert. I'm not going to say after you've seen one, you've seen them. I don't say that. let's see. This was a documentary. Edward Kennedy was obviously going to run. He hadn't announced, but there was every indication. 1979, every indication that he would be a candidate. And so we went to him and said, Senator, and he'd never sat down, he'd done an occasional meet the press or face the nation, but he'd never sat down for a long interview or a documentary. And we went to him and said, this is what we want to do, and we hope you'll cooperate, but if you won't or don't, we're going to do the broadcast anyway. And so we went ahead, and he gave us access, and we shot up at Cape Cod and all that. So then the time came to sit down with him. And I kept trying to find out from him what differences he had on policy with Jimmy Carter. Here's a powerful Democratic senator about to embark on a campaign to unseat a sitting president from his own party. So, I mean, that's a big move politically. So you got to have some reasons. And the reasons, his answers didn't seem to add up to me to enough to justify his challenging Carter. So I said, So why do you want to be president? And I saw the film the other day, and he just looks at me, and the mouth begins to move, and it's 3 or 4 seconds before a sound comes in. And what the answer ran, you know, 450 words, and we ran about 300 of the words on the program because we didn't, you know, we wanted everything in context. And it was obvious he had not thought about it seriously. I think he sort of figured he could ascend to the nomination. But the question itself gets so rarely asked because it's such a softball question. I mean, it's a slow pitch that comes in and you can read the stitches as it, you know, and most politicians would hit it right over the left field wall. But he wasn't prepared for it because I think he hadn't thought about it. And so in subsequent accounts of that and during campaigns, that question is sometimes asked and it's always referred to as the Roger Mudd question. And I guess that's okay to have that hung on me. I don't know. But thank you for asking.
Lady right here, about five rows back with her hand up.
Hi. I stopped watching network news some years ago when all of them started just giving out a lot of fluff. But I did start watching PBS, and I did start watching C-SPAN. And now when I want to know what's going on, I turn on C-SPAN. And I get the information from them as it's happening, where it's happening. And I wonder whether other people are doing the same, rather than turning to the network news who are just telling us stuff which we already know one way or another.
Do you mean C-SPAN or CNN? C-SPAN. Those are two very bright lights on the television horizon. C-SPAN started by a young fellow who was from Colorado, Brian Lamb, and he got legislation through, and it is supported and underwritten by the cable industry. Well, all of you know they cover the House and the Senate and the hearings, and they do speeches all over the country. And they have call-ins, and, you know, it's very well run. The NewsHour on PBS is really a very special program. I think there's probably a ceiling to how large an audience they will ever attract because it requires a good commitment on your time. And you need undivided attention because you get Jim gives the top of the news, a summary, and then the rest of the broadcast is a civil discourse about the issues, and all that's very valuable. But in a time in an era when people are popping from one channel to another, it takes a special viewer to sit and watch the NewsHour. But it's that's right. The Frontline series is very valuable and very tough. That's right. It is, and it's the only full-length documentary channel that I know about. You remember CBS Reports and NBC White Papers? They've all gone, and in the place of CBS Reports is 60 Minutes, which is five little bitty documentaries. You know that don't. You know they last 8 minutes, and that's about that's the audience span now.
Got time for one more question. We'll take the lady in red here.
Hello. Nice to see you. My concern with what's going on with the media right now is the fact that what makes the United States unique...
Ma'am, hold the mic closer to your mouth.
Yeah. What makes the United States unique is the fact that our media is supported by the First Amendment. I'm sorry?
You make it a very specific question. Media is supported by the First Amendment.
In the United States, our media is supported by the First Amendment, and what I'm seeing right now is a focus on entertainment. How do we shift the tide back? Because when we lose the quality of that supporting of the First Amendment, we're not getting informed anymore.
The relationship between the media, and I'm talking specifically about television and not the newspapers, because the relationship between newspapers and the First Amendment is very clear. Congress shall pass no law. That's not clear when it comes to television. And that question, that relationship, that murky relationship, has bedeviled the networks from the very beginning. They're licensed. No question about it, they're licensed. There's an FCC. and they can be fined and have been fined. So as a consequence, the networks are very much afraid to offend the federal government, to stalk the federal government, to face down the federal government, and in big battles between the media, meaning television and newspapers, standing, holding the wall against federal encroachment, television is not an equal partner in that fight because of this special fuzzy relationship. Over the years, television has decided not to challenge its relationship between the government and the protection of the First Amendment because they're afraid they'll lose. They're afraid that if it goes into court and the Supreme Court takes the case, the court, giving the present makeup, will reaffirm the previous cases from lower courts that television is not guaranteed without any restrictions at all the freedom that newspapers have. So there's a limit as to what television can do.
Folks, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you for sharing this Roger Mudd moment.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.